Welcome to another episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages. I'm Logan Quigley. The peasantry constituted an impressive percentage of the medieval population. Much historiography of peasant communities presents them as a homogeneous whole, lacking complexity. In this episode, Elias Carballido Gonzalez reviews various historiographical approaches to early medieval peasant communities, from the coalescing of the very idea of the peasant to the popularization of the microhistory and beyond. Elias Carballido Gonzalez holds a master's degree in gender and diversity from, a bachelor's degree in history from, and is a current PhD candidate at the University of Oviedo. His research considers internal differentiation in early medieval rural communities, focusing on the gendered social and emotional experiences of being single. One of Elias's main objectives is getting to know how people in medieval communities felt and experienced the phenomena that have tended to be studied in a depersonalized way. Our episode begins in the year 963, the night of December 18th, in a small village in northern Spain, with a man named Sanuldo, who has just pled guilty to the death of another man.
Accompanied by several legal officers and his friend Aysen, Sanuldo had, in the middle of the night, broken into the house of a woman from the village, Vita, and had violently removed three men who had been kept there. The encounter was so violent that one of them could not fear his injuries. We do not know more details about the causes that generated this conflict, but we do know that, by virtue of the trial, Sanuldo agreed to deliver several properties to Sandinamonis and his wife Elo. A document of the Celanova Monastery's charter, one of the most important in the northwest of the Iberian Peninsula, allow us to know this story. The sources to study the early Middle Ages in this space are scarce and are characterized by a great complexity. But this is not the only thing that has influenced the knowledge we have about early medieval local communities. A document like this raises many questions. It makes us think about what the relationships were like between the different members of a peasant community. It allows us to get closer to conflict resolution processes, to the intervention of the incipient lordly powers in the inner life of the villages, to issues such as the situation of women. But for us, being able to ask ourselves all these questions, historiography has had to go a long way. It is difficult that the peasantry, more than 90% of the population at this time, did not appear in stories about the Middle Ages. The first question we have to ask ourselves is how the peasantry appeared. What role did this group play? How was it represented? And when we get to these questions, we find one of the main problems. History is not an objective discipline. The characters that we make visible, the events that we highlight, what is relevant to us, all of this has to do with certain lenses that condition our view of the past. Just as 3D glasses make you see certain images, our mind has filters that give a specific shape to what we think. For this reason, I always ask students to think about what filters can come between our supposedly objective thought exercise and the final result. Epistemology is a philosophical discipline that studies scientific knowledge, taking into account its nature, how it is produced, its foundations, and its methods. In this sense, this discipline is an essential ally for any historian to reflect on the data we create about the past. All the knowledge that has been produced in the West in recent centuries has been conditioned by specific ways of thinking. This way of thinking influences how we understand the world, space, time, the ontology of the human being, gender, and the relationship between human beings and nature. These ways of thinking are culturally situated, which means that, while in the West they have given rise to specific understandings, in other cultures these understandings could be different because the foundations of their knowledge, of the way in which they apprehend reality, are different. The scientific development that took off in Europe in the 17th century, the ideas of the Enlightenment, based on rationalism, or the evolutionary ideas of the 19th century, are some of the central components of this way of thinking that is forged in a context in which European societies are advancing towards the Great Industrial Revolution, towards the rise of urban planning, and towards the construction of the modern nation-state. Reason thus became the great transformative tool of society, capable of removing human beings from the darkness of the past and generating promising futures, generating development and opportunities, and consequently providing societies with a better lifestyle. At the same time as these ideas were being consolidated, the notion of the medieval was outlined more clearly. A dark, backward, rudimentary era, where unreason reigned and human beings trusted everything to superstitions. And naturally, the few who were saved from this story were those members of the elite who were necessary to justify the new nationalist explanations about the genesis of future state, the kings who had promoted the unification of a nation, or those who had fought decisive battles. But the peasantry began to become what modernity opposed, and historiography was also influenced by this understanding. Therefore, the peasantry was considered a homogeneous, flat, rudimentary group, without any complexity or agency, and totally subject to the decisions and logics of the feudal lords. The peasantry was a group that did not represent the values of rationalism, or more of modern, urban and industrialized societies, but rather the remains of a dark, rural and to a certain extent magical past. Perhaps for this reason, the peasantry was not necessarily invisible in historiography. It was a fundamental agent to explain the rise of seigneurial power in the Middle Ages, or to generate the negative of what was the most attractive about the Middle Ages. For example, the lords dedicated to war, the clerics of a world in which religion reached every corner of society, or the great monarchs. However, there have been clear historiographical transformations. In the 19th century, an institutionalist approach inspired by the interests of the great theoretical school of the time, historicism, prevailed. Although at this time the relevant thing was to attend to the formation of nations from a political point of view, the few approaches that could be produced to the life of the peasantry had the intention of understanding the institutional or political frameworks that framed their lives, paying close attention, therefore, to the development of lordship and feudalism. At the beginning of the 20th century, the influence of sociology, economics, and structuralist anthropology led to a renewed interest in economic aspects of the life of the peasantry, such as income, work, and the development of agriculture. Under the influence of sociology and anthropology, some authors also began to try to understand rural society from the point of view of family structures or relationships, applying new theoretical frameworks and new concepts. In this sense, George Gordon Coulton's work, The Medieval Village, stands out. But, without a doubt, the two great historiographic schools of the 20th century, Annals and Historical Materialism, were also the two great poles from which decisive advances were made in the study of the peasant world in the Middle Ages. The work published in 1931 by Marc Bloch, Le caractère original de l'histoire rurale française, is a decisive milestone in this evolution. This work carried out a much deeper approach to the rural spaces that he worked on in the area of the Île-de-France and combined the documentary sources that were usually used in the 19th century with new contributions, cartography, landscape analysis, ethnography, something very characteristic of this school. From the field of historical materialism, Annals was normally criticized for maintaining a too natural position, something that could have led to perpetuating old understandings about the peasantry as a group without agency. Georges Duvy's work, Warriors and Peasants, in part offers this dichotomous image of medieval society. Historical materialism made important contributions that, like the Annals, were very relevant to making knowledge about peasant societies of the Middle Ages more complex, providing new data, making visible issues that had previously gone unnoticed, and using a more diverse record of sources. From British Marxism, authors such as Roddy Hilton were precursors in the use of new categories such as social class for understanding the medieval peasantry. Understanding this group as a social class, immersed in a specific mode of production, the feudal, more attention was paid to issues such as the agency, the ability to react to lordly powers, or the group conscience. British historiography made interesting contributions to the study of social conflict in the late Middle Ages and peasant revolts. Little by little, the peasant stopped being that passive subjects who seem to live without incentives or alternatives, only guided by external forces. The advances brought about by the influence of the Annals and historical materialism meant that at the end of the 20th century, there had already been important steps made in the studies of medieval peasantry, and the notion of this group was now more complex. The development of medieval archaeology was very important, a discipline that had previously been marked by a very strong elitist and monumentalist bias. In the northwest of the Iberian Peninsula, medieval archaeology had only paid attention to the great centers of power, those churches and palaces related to the incipient Asturian monarchy that emerged in the 8th century. But at the end of the 90s, a series of historians and archaeologists in the orbit of historical materialism and social history began to develop a new line of study with a renewed methodology inspired by new readings of written documentation and by the development of new lines in medieval archaeology dedicated to the study of the peasantry and agrarian spaces. On the one hand, the research work on written sources benefited from new approaches that drew from a context in which the linguistic turn and post-structuralism illuminated new ideas and new concepts. In this way, historians who studied the peasantry were able to have a better understanding of all the biases contained in documents generated by the elite, both secular and religious, with specific interests and situated in a position of power. On the other hand, these researchers were also aware of the need to look for evidence of peasant lives beyond those documents produced by the elite, and in this way they began to think about the way in which archaeology could pitch in that direction. At this time, new research lines are generated, such as agrarian archaeology or the archaeology of the peasantry. If the question we asked ourselves was how could we find the spaces in which the peasantry lived, or the spaces in which they developed their lives, Archaeology could not offer great answers at that time. That is why we worked to develop new approaches that could allow us to locate peasant contexts. This approach had in fact a lot of influence from microhistory, a historiographical field from the end of the 20th century that focused on the study of what was part of the lowest scale of analysis, of those elements that went unnoticed when we carried out analysis of the elements that stood out most in history. In the northwest of the Iberian Peninsula, studies of microterritories proliferated. These microterritories generally corresponded to the space of a village, a parish, or a manor, and the objective was to carry out very dense analysis combining all types of evidence that could be rescued and in this way propose studies and debates on major topics, but from the information that we could find in localized spaces. Local and regional work also contributed to changing the conception we had about issues such as feudalism, revealing that reality was very diverse and that, when addressing local cases, there were shared features and others that were only present in some spaces and in others not, or that they were exclusive to a certain territory. From the local to the global. That was the approach that directed from then on the work that was done in that research field, in which attention was paid to written sources, toponymy, landscape and parcels, oral records of living rural communities and, of course, archaeology. Medieval villages were generally located several meters below the current ones, so this posed obvious difficulties. But there were some spaces that could be analyzed. In 2013, a team led by Margarita Fernández Mier, professor of medieval history at the University of Oviedo, discovered an early medieval necropolis under the current church of a village in northern Spain called Biraña. This necropolis allowed us to get closer to the peasants who had populated that village more than a millennium before, and to elements that written sources cannot always provide us with, such as their diet, physical condition, or pathologies. Excavating in currently inhabited villages is difficult, however, as there are very few spaces in which the subsoil can be lifted. But it is possible to excavate other spaces that were also part of the daily life of medieval peasants, such as the lands that surrounded the village. The same team carried out various excavations for several years that allowed us to understand how these peasant communities had taken advantage of their territory not only since the Middle Ages, but long before. One of the most important results of this project was the discovery that in the territory that belonged to that village, records could be found that dated back to the Neolithic. In the ditches opened in the crop fields, the remains that could be recovered allowed us to recompose issues related to the species they planted or the environmental changes that these communities had faced, as well as all the adaptations that they had carried out throughout its history to build a specific agricultural landscape, such as the construction of terracing systems. All these data allowed the history of the peasantry to advance exponentially and to cease to be a historical subject that we knew only through the definitions made by the documentation produced by the elite. From then on, we could start understanding them from their own records. The 21st century has seen the emergence in historiography of some fields that originated with postmodernism at the end of the 20th century and that, in general, represented a new interest in cultural issues. In the historiography of the peasantry, the influence of this historiographical change has been milder, since, as we saw, it is a group in which historians have become more recently interested. Already in the 90s, some British medievalists, such as Judith Bennett, carried out some studies in which they tried to know what the situation of women had been in medieval peasant communities. Most studies on peasant women paid attention to the late medieval centuries, analyzing how the transition to modernity and how the appearance of capitalist economic elements transformed their lives. Bennett's study of women brewers is well known, in which the author exemplified how women were displaced from an activity they had traditionally carried out when brewing abandoned its domestic nature and became a larger scale and more lucrative activity. These types of studies were greatly influenced by British Marxism, but in the 21st century, the historiography on peasant women lost a certain vitality. On the other hand, studies that focused on the internal differences of peasant communities did grow. Not all subjects were equal, even though, as Chris Wickham pointed out, women tend the notion that the peasant communities of the medieval period were egalitarian. Internal differences can be detected in economic matters, taking into account, for example, who has greater wealth, who is the owner, or who has the capacity to generate surpluses or high labor. But the differences between the peasantry can also be detected in other elements, such as gender. And furthermore, contemplating other periods that had previously been neglected, such as the early Middle Ages. When I began my doctoral thesis in 2022, my interest was precisely to understand how gender is one of those categories that help us to understand how differences are constructed in local communities. Those communities that Wendy Davis called small worlds in the 80s. But my interest was focused on the early Middle Ages and understanding how the destructuring of the Western Roman world from the 5th century onwards gives way to a world in which many elements are reformulated. Not only political structures, but also identities and interpersonal relationships. Post-Roman Western Europe sees the great trade routes of the Roman era gradually contract. The arrival of Germanic peoples and a new military elite that tries to reuse the infrastructure of the Roman state to continue collecting taxes and administering the territory, although the difficulties are increasing. It is a world that is gradually becoming more rural and local. People's lives are increasingly related to their local environment and are progressively disconnected from the outside. Relationships become closer and more private. That's why we talk about small worlds. The northwest of the Iberian Peninsula reflects these dynamics perfectly, since in addition, it is a space that even in Roman times had been very rural and where power never had the establishment that it had in more Romanized areas. Starting in the 5th century, we see how these Roman elites disappear or are transformed into something new. We appreciate the emergence of a series of local powers, which had the capacity to control not very extensive spaces and would take us to a new world. At this time, very few sources help us to study what was happening in those small spaces, and that is why archaeology has been our great ally. Celia Rodriguez has been one of the pioneers in applying a gender perspective to the study of the northwest of the peninsula in recent years. In her doctoral thesis, defended in 2021, she presented research through which she had studied the Castro or Hilford communities of Galaecia, a Roman province that occupied more or less the space of the current Spanish regions of Galicia, Asturias, and León, as well as the north of Portugal. The hillfolds are a type of settlement that we find in this territory and whose origins are pre-Roman. It constitutes one of the several types of settlements that coexisted in Roman times. Celtia focused on studying what happens in these settlements between the 4th and the 6th centuries, that is, in the period in which such important transformations occurred in the Roman world. And based on the analysis of settlement spaces and necropolis, as well as their material culture, she confirmed how in periods of instability, such as the one experienced at the end of the empire in the 4th and 5th centuries, relational identity increased in these spaces. Relational identity refers to belonging to the group, referring to the collective, as opposed to the emergence of individuality that characterizes modern societies. Almudena Hernando, a prestigious Spanish prehistorian and specialist in gender and identity, maintains that since prehistory, women had been the subjects in charge of maintaining group ties. Celtia Rodriguez argues that the new articulations in settlements and necropolis at the beginning of the early Middle Ages seem to refer to a change in mentalities and social dynamics, something that could fit with this emphasis on the relational, the collective, intense moments. And her hypothesis is that women would have been able to enjoy, as a consequence, a greater degree of representation and freedom in this time. The work of this researcher is fundamental due to the theoretical gap that existed in the study of these local communities in the early Middle Ages, and because her analysis of gender relations is totally connected to the sociopolitical dynamics that occurred during the passage of the Roman world to the early medieval world. If we move forward in time a few centuries, we find a new type of source for the study of these communities, the monastic cartularies. In the early Middle Ages, the founding of private monasteries by the elite became popular, a social, family, and economic strategy. From the 8th century onwards, these monasteries began to produce written documentation aimed mainly at collecting all those diplomas that justified their properties. At this time, the power of the lordships advanced exponentially in the Western European space. In the northwest of the Iberian Peninsula, characterized by the existence of free peasant owners, the power of those incipient lordships comes into conflict with those small communities that try to maintain their rights and not fall under the power and the jurisdiction of these new powers. But the truth is that the cartularies of the monasteries of the Northwest constitute a record of great value to enter the world of the villages of the early Middle Ages. Thanks to them, we can learn about their neighbors, their territory, property transactions, and even in some cases, lawsuits that provide us with a lot of data about the inner relations of these communities. At the end of the Middle Ages, we see a more complex society, in which some members of the community have begun to differentiate themselves not only by the volume of property or wealth they accumulate, but also by the new relationships they have established with those lordly powers that advance in their territory. Women appear, although they are not the ones who usually occupy the leading role. A simple reading helps us to discover that not all women were the same. The most visible women, evidently, are those who belong to the local or supralocal elites who owned property in these rural communities. The end of the early Middle Ages marks a fundamental turning point due to the transition from the more extensive typical family model of the early Middle Ages to a smaller unit that will be characteristic of the High and the Late Middle Ages, at the same time that patrilineality is established as the main means of inheritance. This fact has been seen as one of the main processes that could reduce female agency and visibility in the transition from the early medieval world to the high and late medieval world. and evidently, in the villages, this change in the conception of the family also had clear effects. In the early Middle Ages, we see that village women owned land and sometimes carried out transactions independently, without their husbands. In the 1000s, a new type of Tory also spread that supplanted the Germanic tradition of Morgengave, by which the husband's family gave the wife capital, usually in the form of land, for a new model of Roman inspiration by which was the wife's family that had to give a dowry to the husband. From this moment on, what the bride receives is usually in the form of gifts or money, which represents a decline in her possessions. These peasant women traded with their properties, but in a different way than we see in men. When the Dalys, who studied in depth the donations from the northwest of the peninsula, collected in the documentation, observed that they tended to appear donating property to eliminate debts, mainly, while men usually appeared in those donations that had a compensatory purpose for reasons of honor, such as when an offense had been committed. In this case, gender dynamics are appreciated, since the offense used to be a damage to masculinity, to the integrity of the male, who was the subject who occupied the central role in this peasant society. On many occasions, we see that the visibility of women increases when they become widows. Traditionally, it was considered that widowed women had greater agency and freedom, and that this situation was to a certain extent empowering. But in local communities, we sometimes discover widowed women making donations to monasteries, for example, on the condition of obtaining protection. These examples allow us to approach another dimension, that of those women who were left alone in a world designed for men, which could mean greater risks and challenges for them, and a situation of vulnerability than in the case of those who had the resources could be alleviated by, for example, asking the powerful for protection. Vulnerability is something that we also detect in old age. In 954, Gogino donated several properties to the monks of Selanova on the condition that they clothed and fed him for the remainder of his life. Something similar appears in a carta from 998, in which a couple, Meduma and Lita, make a donation with the aim of getting them fed and defended in return. Could it be a couple that, in their old age, aware of the vulnerability that this implied, decided to seek protection and security? In a society where, as the documents reveal, men used to be associated with a masculinity linked to violence, so old age could represent a significant handicap that could affect the individual's gender identity. On other occasions, the documents also allow us to approach other issues that tell us about the relationships between the members of these peasant communities, such as sexuality. When sources refer to this topic, it is usually because they refer to situations that are out of the norm, such as concubinate, sexual abuse, or assault. In the year 989, for example, Gigulfo transferred several properties to the monastery of Selanova due to the sexual collusion he had committed with Siscundia. Sexual collusion was classified at this time and place as an illegitimate union between unfree persons, although this case is striking because the same couple appears as owners in another carta. A decade later, in the 1000s, the monastery of Selanova demanded that Fajildo once again submit to its dependence after having married Feriola, a servant of the monastery, and having placed himself under the power of Count of Eco. The studies of the medieval peasantry are currently in a stage of full vitality. The young researchers who dedicate our work to the study of these communities overlord to those who preceded us, who paved the way by theorizing about the methodologies that were necessary to find that historical subject that for centuries was imperfectly constructed by elitist discourses that did not allow us to see its reality. Today, this field has already opened up to the entry of other lines of research that try to go beyond the social, economic, and political characterization of this group to delve into issues that have to do with their beliefs, their experiences, their relationships, their ways of life. And this is where gender studies, or the history of emotions, two lines of research that I tried to combine in my doctoral thesis, are fundamental. Because beyond that history from below that represented so many advances in the social history of the 20th century, it is still necessary to develop that history from within, the one that allows us to connect with the feelings, with the impressions, with the lived experience of some people of these local communities that were small but very diverse. Thank you so much for your attention.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beasy, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.